ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
So this morning we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, chapter 50. Krishna establishes Dwaraka. Text number 54 and 55. For those of you that don't know, there's a section of New Delhi called Dwaraka. And ISKCON is building a big, huge temple there, as if they don't have enough temples already in Delhi. But there's a big, huge temple coming up. It's right near the airport. So you may get a chance to visit it. That's about, 8, 10, 12, however many. All glories to Gopal Krishna and Goswami Maharaj. So the word meanings, to text number 54, I'll go through, then we can chant together that. And then we'll chant 55. Sudharma, the Sudharma Assembly Hall, Parijatam, the Parijata Tree, Cha, and Mahaindra, Lord Indra, King of Heaven, Prahinat, delivered Hare to Lord Krishna, Yatra, in which Sudharma, Cha, and Avastitaha, situated Marja, immortal, Marja Dharmai, by the law of mortality, Nayuyate, is not affected. Sudharma Parijitam Cha. Mahindra Prahino Dare. Yatra ka vasito marjo marjo dharmai nayuyate sudharmam parijatam cha mahindra prahino dare Yatra ka vasito marjo marjo dharmai nayuyate sudharmam parijatam cha mahindra prahino dare Yatra ka vasito marjo Marcha Dharma Nayuyate
Yeah.
translation. Lord Indra brought Sri Krishna the Sudharma assembly hall, standing within which a mortal man is not subject to the laws of mortality. Indra also gave the Parijata tree. Text 55, we can chant together. Samaika varna varuno hayam supa mano jadam asto niri pati kosam lokapalo yujodayam. Lord Varuna offered horses as swift as the mind, some of which were pure dark blue, others white. The treasurer of the demigods, Kuvera, gave his 8 mystic treasures, and the rulers of various planets each presented their own opulences. Purport. Srila Sridhar Swami comments as follows on this verse. The master of the treasury is Kuvera, and the 8 treasures are his nidhis. These are described as follows. Padmas, Chaiva, Mahapadmo, Matsya, Kurmo, Tatao, Daka, Nilo, Mukunda, Sankascha, Nidhayo, So, Parichiti, Parichita. The 8 mystic treasures are called Padma, Mahapadma, Matsya, Kurma, Audaka, Nila, Mukunda, and Shankar. Om Gana Tamarandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Shashu Nuritam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So here Krishna is establishing Dwarka. It's interesting, and I don't know the answer to this question, but I wonder, the title of the chapter, Krishna establishes Dwarka, doesn't say Krishna built Dwarka, or as Mukunda Prabhu was pointing out yesterday, that Vishwakarma built Dwarka, but Dwarka is the eternal dham of the Lord, and it appeared. And so that seems to coincide with the chapter title, which describes Krishna establishing Dwarka rather than building it. And that's important, I think, because it establishes a way we think about these different subject matters. I asked a question at the end of class yesterday about modern discoveries such as the walls under the sea just off the coast of present-day Gujarat, near Dwarka, and the bridge that we find in South India, going between, seen by satellite photos, going between the Indian subcontinent and the island of Sri Lanka. How do we think about these things? And my point in bringing that question up was really only clarified in my own mind later in the day from discussion with my wife. And that is, do we accept the descriptions of the Shastra with faith, or do we first place our faith in sort of modern-day corroboration of what is described in the Shastra? Which comes first in our mind? Now I believe because there's a satellite photo of the bridge underneath the sea between South India and Sri Lanka, or that there are ruins being discovered off the coast of Dwarka in the Arabian Sea. Do I believe and have faith? Is my faith increased because of that, or is my faith based on the Shastra and the descriptions are there alone, and it's nice that there's modern corroboration? So how we think about all the things that we read in the Shastra, particularly things which are beyond our comprehension or seemingly ability, the ability of modern man, I think is very important. Obviously, I would advocate we have faith in the Shastra first. And that faith can and should be strong enough that we don't need corroboration of modern scientific methods. We used to run into this question a lot when I was on a library party, because we would be meeting with professors every day and presenting Prabhupada's books. And question would often arise, how things which are inconceivable in the Shastra, inconceivable to our modern minds, to our current mindset, how they can be accepted. And obviously the answer is faith, but when there are these types of modern corroboration, it's good. It's good for those that don't have faith, not for those that have faith. So that's what I meant by my question yesterday. And the subject matter sort of continues into today's verse, as we find in the first verse, text number 54, Indra giving the Sudharma assembly house to Krishna for placement in Dwarka. Now it says here in the verse that a mortal man is not subject to the laws of mortality. So if that Sudharma assembly house, you enter it, I assume that death can't touch you there. Those are the laws of mortality, that we all die in this world. So that was his gift to Krishna. But was it really his gift? Was this really his gift? And this gets back to the point that Mukunda was making, is that did Vishwakarma build it, or did it just manifest and he got some role in it? Interior decorating, I think Mukunda said. Is it Indra's Sudharma Hall, or is it Krishna's Sudharma Assembly Hall? It's Krishna's. And he reciprocates with his devotees by giving different roles to the devotees to play. And so Indra played the role of giving the Sudharma Assembly House. And Kubera is mentioned in the next verse as giving his eight mystic treasures. Now I tried to find out what those eight mystic treasures are, and of course they're listed here in the verse quoted by Srila Sridhar Swami. They're listed: Padma, Mahapadma, Matsya, Kurma, Odaka, Nila, Mukunda, Shankha. Eight mystic treasures. So I tried to find out what are those, what are those treasures? And actually, you know, there's not much information about what those treasures actually are. I looked in a lot of different places to try to get a description. Well, Shankha means this kind of treasury, this kind of wealth. But they're hard to find. Actually, some places it describes that these eight mystic treasures are actually personified. They're like the associates, personal associates of Kubera. It's not clearly explained or understood exactly what they are. But we can understand one thing about them, and I think this is the most important thing, and it's related to this idea of the Shastra containing things which are fantastic descriptions. One thing we can understand about these eight mystic opulences of Kubera are, is that They're not his natural opulences. He's been granted them. He's received them from another source. I found in the Puranic Encyclopedia, you know, Vaitam Mani's Puranic Encyclopedia. Have you seen that? There's electronic versions. I have the book version. But good reference point, because it describes all different stories and references them to different Puranas and the Mahabharata. And so there's a description of Kubera and two of these eight mystic opulences that's described as follows. It's describing Kubera in Lanka. And Lanka is his kingdom, present-day island of Sri Lanka, where he had his headquarters, his treasury. So afterwards, Kubera performed penance for 10,000 years in water with his head submerged to please Brahma. Yet Brahma did not appear. Then he performed penance standing on one foot in the center of Panchagni, five fires. Brahma appeared and asked him to choose any boon. Kubera requested that he might be made a lokapalaka. That's all. Lokapalas are also mentioned in the verse, second verse today. He wanted to be a lokapalaka, a protector of the universe, and the custodian of wealth. And Brahma responded by supplying Kubera the treasures Shankha Nidhi and Padma Nidhi, and also the Pushpaka Vimana, and as a vehicle. So one thing we do know about these eight mystic treasures of Kubera is that he had to perform penance to get them. They weren't his natural opulences. And you'll find, actually, anyone throughout the Puranas, throughout the Mahabharata, anyone who has some opulence, and I'm making a broad statement here, and maybe I should back off from it a bit because I haven't read all these things personally. But my understanding is that to obtain any kind of opulence, one has to perform some kind of penance or austerity, and those things are gifted to one as a reward. Whether one performs these kind of austerities and penances, standing on one leg in the middle of five fires, or meditating with your head underwater for 10,000 years, or performing 100 Aswamedha sacrifices, there's something that one has to undergo to be benedicted with these opulences. And that's true for everyone except for one person. Who is it not true for? It's not true for Krishna, Vishnu. You don't find descriptions. Vishnu performing austerities for 10,000 years, 100,000 years to get his opulences. They're his natural opulences. He's Lakshmipati. He's the controller, the husband, the lord of the goddess of fortune. And so we should understand that this difference between Vishnu and all the other demigods that we hear descriptions of is that Vishnu's wealth, his opulences, are his own natural opulences. And so here we find in description of Srimad Bhagavatam all the demigods giving back the opulences which they have received, offering them to Krishna. And Prabhupada gives the example one, like a little child. A child completely dependent upon its parents for food, but when he gets that food, he offers it back. And that loving exchange is very pleasing to the parent. So that's what we're meant to do with any opulence we have. We should understand its origin and how it's best utilized. Just a quick side note, because the verse talks about lokapalas, the rulers of various planets. And the point is made also, it says in the verse, their own opulences. They presented their own opulences. Well, they're not really their own. They're bestowed with these things, and they're offering them back. But it says Lokapala. Now, when I had darshan this morning of Sri Sri Krishna Balaram, I thought, well, this is Lokapala. Look at those sticks they're carrying. You know, they're going to rule with those sticks. You know, they're Lokapala, not the demigods. They have that position, and they're showing that to us with those wonderful sticks. So I thought that I would talk a little bit about wealth, since that's the subject matter here, and to try to further illustrate this philosophical point of the owner and controller of opulences and the correct use of all opulences. Srila Prabhupada gave us a couple of stories that can help us remember this principle. So Srila Prabhupada on wealth. He used to say that a devotee of the Lord, if he gets a donation, say from a very rich person, $1 million, that he'll take that $1 million and he'll spend it in the Lord's service in one day, and the next day he'll knock on that gentleman's door again and say, can you give another $1 million? Because he had no hesitancy in understanding that this money, Lakshmi, is the energy, the Shakti of the Supreme Lord, and it's meant for use for the Supreme Lord. So he would do that without any hesitation and then come back the next day for more, because all of it belongs to Krishna. He also told us a story about how a Vaishnava regards wealth or money in general. And he compared and contrasted the Vaishnava to another spiritual leader in India who used to say that whenever anyone comes to offer him money, his hand automatically turns away. In other words, you get money, someone's giving you money, you put your hand out like that. But this man said, no, his hand automatically turns away. Prabhupada criticized this because Lakshmi, money, the Shakti of the Lord is meant for engagement in the service of the Lord, so why are you turning your hand away? As if it's some source of contamination or something. No, it's meant to be engaged. And so these two stories, give us some idea of how Prabhupada understood wealth and utilized wealth in the service of the Lord. So there are many other types of instructions, particularly of Lord Chaitanya, to his devotees concerning wealth. I'm going to read a little bit some of those things. We can discuss. First, in Lord Chaitanya's discussion with Ramananda Rai, the subject came up about what is the most valuable thing in the world. Wealth obviously has value, and so what's the most valuable thing in the world? This came up in the discussion. Lord Chaitanya asked, I'll just read. Lord Chaitanya next asked Ramananda Rai, what is the most valuable thing in the world? Ramananda Rai replied that he who has love for Radha Krishna possesses the most valuable jewel and the greatest riches. One who is addicted to material sense gratification or material wealth is not really to be considered wealthy. Why is that? Who can say why? Having love for Radha and Krishna makes one wealthy. Anybody? Anything? Yes. Very good. Devotion is the highest platform of spiritual enlightenment. And on that platform, you get love of Krishna. You have love of Krishna. So that's one thing about wealth. Wealth sort of like separates you from the rest, right? The cream rises to the top. And so the top of society is so-called the wealthy class. And so wealth gives that exclusivity. And so, yes, being on the topmost platform, that can be compared to wealth. That's where we find Radha Krishna. Thank you. Anyone else have anything to add? Yes.
Well, we can say all kind of material wealth is temporary, it's ephemeral, it disappears. You cannot really enjoy that eternally. But the treasures, the wealth, the spiritual one, especially the one which is related with Radha Krishna, is eternal. It's eternal benefit. And it can be transmitted to others to give the best help or assistance to other living beings, when you can give that knowledge of, to them.
Right, right. They're very good. It's not temporary. And that's important, because wealth in this material world, Lakshmi is called Chanchala. She's here one day, gone the next, and it can't really satisfy you, isn't it? Because if you feel like you're going to lose wealth at any time, you're in anxiety. How you want to hold on to her? How you want to control her? But if you understand that the wealth you get from the love of Radha Krishna is eternal and it's not going to go away, then you feel a lot more peaceful. And he brings up another very interesting point. Prabhuji says that it can be given to other people. A lot of wealthy people, what they do when they have wealth is they give it to others, and they find satisfaction in doing that. And so Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has also asked us to do that. Prabhupada also asked us to do that. Now you've attained this wealth. I've broken open the storehouse of love of God. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went and saw where all the wealth was. It was in love of God, in a big storehouse, where a big go-down, where all the money and the wealth was, all these riches were. And he's plundered that, just like one plunders wealth. And he's giving it out freely to everyone. And he's asked us, you take it, and I only ask you one thing in return. What does he ask in return? That you give it to others. That's all. I've given it to you. You just give it to others. And so, yes, that's how love of Radha Krishna is wealth. Anyone else have any ideas? Yes.
That one shloka, Charja Prema Shatra, this prema is amazing charja, because it increases 100 times when you plunder it and give it out. This amazingly increases 100 times every time. Prema Shatra Guna by the Spaniard.
Yes, wow, what a wonderful thing. Not only is it an unlimited treasure house, but it increases when you give it out. More is there. What a wonderful... What a wonderful source of wealth that is. Yes, so let me just finish this section from Chaitanya from the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. When one comes to the spiritual platform, Krishna consciousness, he can understand that there are no riches more valuable than love of Radha Krishna. It is recorded in Srimad Bhagavatam that Maharaj Dhruva sought out the Supreme Lord because he wanted to get some land. But when he finally saw Krishna, he said, "I am so pleased. I don't want anything." In Bhagavad Gita also it is stated that if one takes shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, or is elevated to the supreme state of love of Godhead, he has nothing more to aspire for. Although such devotees can attain whatever they desire from the Lord, they do not ask anything from him. So this is another aspect of wealth, isn't it? That it provides a certain amount of satisfaction. But material wealth can't provide that, because we're always afraid that it's going to disappear. But spiritual wealth not only provides, a strong satisfaction that you don't desire anything else. If this unqualified soul got into the spiritual world, the first thing I would do would go to a wish-fulfilling Kulpa Bhiksha tree and ask for all kinds of material benediction. But the residents of the spiritual world don't do that. Why? Why don't they do that? Because they're completely satisfied. They don't have anything to ask for. They don't have anything except for service to Krishna. That's all. And so this is such a unique form of wealth that has this type of characteristic, that one doesn't want anything more. So that was the discussion between Lord Chaitanya and Ramananda Rai. Now, there is another discussion with Lord Chaitanya, between Lord Chaitanya and Sanatana Goswami. And there's an interesting story there told about an astrologer and a poor man. The astrologer came to the house of a poor man, and he was surprised to see that he was so poor. And he said, "Don't you know that your father left you a great treasure?" And so he began to tell this poor man about the treasure, where to find it out. So which direction did he find it in? Who knows? He found the treasure by digging in the east. And what does that for us signify?
India.
Yeah, India, yes. But if you're in India, what does it signify? Bengal, yes. You're looking to the east. The sun, the two lords, Nittai Gaur, are like the sun and the moon rising simultaneously in the eastern sky. And there, they brought us the treasure of the holy name of the Lord. And so the astrologer advised him, dig in the east and you'll find this treasure. And by that treasure, you'll be completely satisfied. No need for us to be forlorn and full of anxiety and distress in this material world. There's no need for us. We are like that poor man. Because actually, our Father has left each and every one of us a wonderful treasury. We're so fortunate. We just have to seek it out in the right way. Don't be fooled by other paths. Yoga, jnana, karma. These things only cause more distress. Focus exclusively on bhakti. And a bhakti process which is very easy obtained just by chanting Hare Krishna. I saw yesterday a quote from Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur where he said that anyone who sincerely chants the holy names of the Lord will achieve complete perfection in the course of his ordinary activities. Something to that effect. He'll achieve complete perfection in the course of his ordinary activities. So you don't have to change everything. You don't have to give up this, you know, whatever. Just chant Hare Krishna sincerely. And by doing that, you'll attain perfection even in the course of your ordinary activities. That's such a wonderful thing. In the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Nectar Devotion, Srila Rupa Goswami also describes the benefit of spiritual wealth. First of all, he describes that it's very rare. Now, wealth is rare, although if everyone had $1 million, then $1 million wouldn't indicate one being wealthy. It's rare. It's special. As Prabhuji said, it's put you in a top platform. So devotional service to the Supreme Lord is like that, and therefore it's actually our wealth. It's rare. In the very beginning of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, the characteristics of pure devotional service are described. And one of them is the rareness of pure devotional service. So we should understand how wealthy we are by understanding how rare it is that we have the opportunity to take part in this process. So I'll just read a little bit from the book here, Prabhupada's Nectar Devotion. Krishna can easily offer a person material happiness or even liberation, but he does not agree very easily to award a person engagement in his devotional service. Devotional service can in fact be attained only through the mercy of a pure devotee. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhyalila 19.151 it is said, by the mercy of the spiritual master who is a pure devotee, and by the mercy of Krishna, one can achieve the platform of devotional service. There is no other way. The rarity of devotional service is also confirmed in the Tantra Shastras, where Lord Shiva says to Sati, my dear Sati, if one is a very fine philosopher, analyzing the different processes of knowledge, he can achieve liberation from material entanglement. By performance of ritualistic sacrifices recommended in the Vedas, one can be elevated to the platform of pious activities and thereby enjoy material comforts of life to the fullest extent. But all such endeavors can hardly offer anyone devotional service to the Lord, not even if one tries for it by such processes for many, many thousands of births. So it's a very rare gift that we have. We kind of take it for granted. We can come here to the temple and there's someone speaking on Srimad Bhagavatam, or there's a nice chanting of Hare Krishna, there's always beautiful deity worship. But these things are very, very rare indeed. And we should treat them as such, just as we would with a great deal of wealth. And another aspect of wealth is one who's completely satisfied. That's also one of the symptoms of pure devotional service. Pure devotional service derides the concept of liberation. So there's a little bit described here. We'll go back to Srila Sridhar Swami's commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam, which started this discussion. And it is confirmed in the Bhavartha Dipika, Srila Sridhar Swami's commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam. My dear Lord, for some of the fortunate persons who are swimming in the ocean of your nectar of devotion and who are relishing the nectar of the narrations of your pastimes, certainly no ecstasies which immediately minimize the value of the happiness derived from religiousness, economic development, sense gratification, and liberation. Such a transcendental devotee regards any kind of happiness other than devotional service no better than a straw in the street. When will that day be mine when I see any kind of material happiness is no better than a straw in the street? Then I'll know that I'm a very fortunate person. And finally, what is our wealth? Each one of us sitting here today, what is our wealth? What is our wealth? Well, I would answer that question by suggesting you look around the room and see the other devotees, because they are our wealth. By taking shelter of them, by serving them, by engaging in devotional service with them, any talent or any wealth that we would desire is immediately available to us. And it's through the devotees. We don't have to be a wonderful kirtan singer, because if we have a wonderful kirtan singer in our midst, he or she can sing in glorification of the Lord, and we can get the benefit just as if we were singing so beautifully. We don't have to be a wonderful pujari who can gorgeously decorate the deity every day, because the devotees that do that service, they do it in such a way that we can benefit from that. We get the same benefit. So our wealth is our sangha. And through that sangha, all good things can be attained. Even if we're not strong in devotional service and devotional practices, what can we do? We can take shelter of those who are strong. in devotional practice, get their association and benefit by being in their presence. It's a great wealth, all the devotees of the Lord. You should appreciate that and utilize it, take advantage of it. Because sometimes we may find ourselves in the most regrettable position. And that position would be bereft of the association of the devotees of the Lord. So covet that wealth very carefully. So these are some thoughts on the verse, two verses today. Krishna establishes Dwarka. And any comments or questions that anyone has, sure come.
Very nice. I didn't want to get back into the material side, especially when you've given all these lovely philosophical and spiritual understanding of this process. But going back to Kuvira, like wherever he said he was residing in Lanka, he resided in Lanka for some time, but then he was driven out of Lanka. And then he took shelter in the Himalayas. You know, he was residing in the Himalayas. And I know up to the time of the Pandavas, he was there, but then maybe now it might be he's residing in a spiritual form or something like that. And the other point, when you said, do our faith have to depend on research and findings? Of course not, but sometimes, for example, like the question came up yesterday, it stated that Lanka is 100 yojanas from the tip of India, but then we know it's, and 100 yojanas is 800 miles, and we know like it's just like 20 miles across. So then that would kind of bewilder faith to some degree, or even the description of the art in the fifth canto and stuff. So sometimes, but I'm certain that within the Shastra there are answers for these things, but we probably have not, you know, gotten that.
Anything else? Yes, Dharma.
I just want to say something and then ask a question. This morning there was a mishap on the altar, and if you notice, you're going to see that there are mismatching backdrops this morning there. So I was thinking, well, maybe there's a reason, because I couldn't find all three backdrops. So with Lord Gaura, Gaunitai, we put on the rising moon. And so I saw it as coincided with your class. You were talking about Lord Chaitanya Nityananda as the rising moon rising there. So it's like kind of make a connection in my mind as to probably, you know, there's a reason why that's there.
Hare Krishna.
So I was thinking about this Sudharma house that it grants immortality to whoever goes there, as what is described. And I was just wondering, well, you sort of touched on the point, but I'm just kind of speculating a little more as to how is it that Kuvira was able to offer something that's immortal when we know that he himself was not. I know you mentioned of it's a father's gift, but that he's offering again, but is there some kind of a little more explanation that can make
well,
it clear?
I don't completely understand what it means when it says that the laws of immortality, because we know that Lord Brahma was requested by Hiranyakasipu to give him immortality, and he said, I can't give that to you. And Lord Brahma is the topmost of all the devas. And so the Sudharma Assembly House, how one becomes free who are not subject to the laws of mortality actually work, I don't know. That's, as you said, something you probably have to look at elsewhere in the Shastra to find out. But Abrahma Bhuvana Loka Puna Avatana Ojana Mama Pecha Tukuntaya Punana Janana Vijite. Everyone in this world, from the topmost planet to the bottom, they're subject to, you know, birth and death. So obviously there's something that needs further understanding there. Yes.
A couple of examples came in my mind in regards to Dharmaraj Prabhu's question about how you can give something when you yourself don't have it, but it seems like it happens. Like I was thinking about how Lord Shiva, when he wanted to enter the Rasa dance, he couldn't, and yet Purnamasi gave him the benediction that he can give that benediction or boon or for others to go in the Rasa dance. In other words, he can make sure not to let others come and let others go, those who are qualified. Or I was thinking, even I think in Kuvera and Dhruva's case, I think Kuvera gave Dhruva that benediction of pure devotional service. I kind of remember reading that one long time ago and having the same question. But when Dhruva asked for some benediction, then that Kuvera gave that benediction. So it seems like there might be examples of you may not have it and yet you're given that, yet you can give that benediction.
Okay.
Hare Krishna, I have a comment and a question. First of all, thank you very much for a very, very inspiring class, very amazing class. And the question is, could you please kindly expand a little bit deeper on and explain more the concept of sincere chanting?
Well, sincere chanting, and there, I think there's a whole retreat in Govardhana or Varshana by Satchinanda Swami on sincere chanting. So I don't know how much I can say here, although I can say that, as I was mentioning, we have a shared wealth in the community and the association of devotees. And there are devotees that, at least in my mind, I see them as sincerely endeavoring to chant the holy name. And like Satchinandan Swami, for instance, he emphasizes, and he goes to japa retreats and so many things where he emphasizes a heartfelt experience in chanting. And I think that that's important, you know, that when we chant our japa, we have a heartfelt experience. Now, at least in my own case, that may not be the case every day, but I can understand what it means by hearing him, his descriptions, not only him, but Mahatma Prabhu, our own from our own community here. He also does seminars where they delve into what does it mean to be sincere in chanting. And it makes you stop and think, apart from the routine of just getting my rounds done every day, how do I actually become deeply absorbed? And devotees have sort of specialized in this, and they offer instruction in this, and we should take that instruction. It's not something that maybe can be captured in a few sentences, but rather it's experienced by taking the time out of our daily and busy schedules to get away and just focus exclusively on chanting Hare Krishna. That way we can understand. I think that we should probably end there. Grantarachuma Bhagavatam.